I'm speaking today with Dr. Angèle Théard, who is the medical director of neuroanesthesiology and an assistant professor of anesthesiology and perioperative medicine at the OHSU School of Medicine. Dr. Théard, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Desiree.
You have been working in the trenches now for months as an anesthesiologist at OHSU. That has got to have taken, I would imagine, like an amazing both physical and emotional toll, especially given your role in intubating patients who are going on ventilators.
Yes, it's been a process. And when you ask that question, it explains to me why I am actually tired. It, you know, something like this, you know, when you're working in a hospital, particularly as an anesthesiologist, it's a very dynamic experience. And there's really no time to stop, even for something like COVID. And so I remember very well being called in an emergency situation to intubate a patient. And one day you're in the intensive care unit, you're intubating someone, and you see that there's massive inflammation and the airway, which is like opening to the larynx and the trachea. And you see it, you know, very inflamed, very beefy red, and you're not wearing any protection except for what you normally wear, which is maybe your hat. And then 2 days later, when everyone's kind of coming together with this COVID-19 disease, and now you have all of this PPEs are here, and you just keep thinking, oh my goodness, was I exposed to this thing that I'm not sure what it is? And then you spend all this time reading and finally hear, oh, it's about a 9 to 14 day incubation. So you just keep counting the days, hoping. And, you know, as a healthcare worker, you're very aware of the risk, but, you know, the focus is always the patient and you're always thinking about it. But this is an extra layer of stress when you start thinking about bringing this home to your family. Being on the front line, an emergency is an emergency. And, you know, initially there was no testing. So the recommendation was everyone is COVID suspect. So you treat everyone like they have COVID. And, you know, that means you do everything you can to protect yourself. But, you know, you have your family. So, you know, if I was on backup call, which I was a few times, as things were kind of starting to kind of ramp up and people were learning more about this. And so I would come home, I would go straight into the shower, I would put all my stuff to wash, and a couple times I was on backup call, I'd have to go back 2 or maybe 3 times. That means every time I would change out of my scrub, put my clothes on, come home. Because I was in a hospital that was probably more concentrated with COVID, I'm going to assume, I would put all my stuff in the laundry, take a shower, and then I could talk to my kids and my family. So you really start to become aware of the risk that you pose to your family and the outside environment. So it was very easy for me when they were talking about mask everywhere to comply. That was not even a question. It takes a huge toll. And I think sometimes as physicians, we tend to kind of numb ourselves to that, thinking that we're just used to it. But it really, at the end of the day, when we're sitting down in a chair and we're having a hard time getting up, you have to come to terms with what it takes from you. It's really, really difficult. And the next day you do it again and again and again. And some days are much more taxing than other days, and you still have to do it, and you want to come back and have something left to give to your family. So it definitely very, very, very challenging. And COVID has added to that angst. And I do worry about the impact that that type of toll can take on people for a long period of time, like it has. I think we're in month 8 or 9 now.
Yeah, I mean, can we throw into that the ways in which being a physician or healthcare provider of color is also like really compounding, I would imagine, the roles of, to be a woman who is a woman of color in that setting, I would imagine that just the daily toll of microaggressions and, you know, other kinds of stresses of just being Black in the U.S., or being a person of color in the U.S. Has got to put people at even higher risk of that in terms of that daily stress.
Yes, it does. The end of May, George Floyd was strangled, the knee to his neck, and it was televised everywhere. This is all happening at the same time. People talk about this vicarious racism and the stress that you start to internalize that actually affects you. So as a physician, you're thinking about COVID, you're thinking about your family, you're thinking about taking care of patients, you're thinking about patients being sick, and then you're thinking about systemic racism and Black Lives Matter. And then I remember one night my daughter's, you know, we came home and my daughter's like, you know, we have to go protest. And parents, you're saying, no, I want you to stay in. I'm thinking of COVID, and I'm also thinking about tear gas and whatever else is going to happen out there. And they're 21 and 19, and they're saying, we have to. And so, can I tell you how you feel? at 8 o'clock as the sun is setting, going to work tomorrow, and I'm thinking my kids are out, and but I'm giving them room to be able to deal with this thing that is so awful.
A lot of data about, for example, low birth weight among African-American babies, right? And the ways in which the single variable that they've linked that to is the lifelong toll of racism. And so, you know, we know that healthcare workers in the era of COVID, healthcare workers of color are dying at disproportionate rates to white workers. I mean, there could be sort of multiple layers of that. But you work particularly with medical residents. Are you seeing the impacts of Black Lives Matter in the context of OHSU, in the context of training future healthcare workers?
In response to the disparities of COVID, as well as the issue of systemic racism as manifest by the public display of the death of George Floyd, medical centers are looking at this chart that they've had on the table for quite some time to make the healthcare workforce more diverse. And so it's causing a lot of these centers to look at their policies and their practices in this quest to become anti-racist. So it's very important to look at where we're at in terms of Black in medicine. So if you look at medical school graduates, somewhere around 6-7% of medical school graduates are Black versus 50% are white. And then you kind of look the next step after medical school, you graduate from medical school, you become a resident. 4% of residents are Black. So the number goes down. And then you look recent information from the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education. You see that Black residents, this is data from 2019, Black residents are dismissed disproportionately compared to whites. In 2015, more than 20% of residents dismissed for whatever reason were Black, and they were in surgery, pediatrics, internal medicine, and anesthesiology. This was on Twitter for several weeks. And so there's this movement to try to increase representation, but what is happening within these spaces during their education? And this is what I'm constantly kind of thinking about, is the educational space that they're in supportive of these trainees so that, one, they get through their residency, and even more importantly, they become faculty of color to mentor the next generation of underrepresented groups. And when I think about that, it makes me think it's more than just promoting diversity, but it's actually making sure that these residents and trainees are in spaces that promote inclusion and equity and support. So there are a lot of barriers that people talk about, and the barriers to the success of underrepresented learners in medicine. A big part of the problem is implicit bias, lack of mentorship. These things lead to isolation within medicine. And it's interesting, we talk a lot about isolation now in terms of COVID. And so when I think about the underrepresented in medicine, and I'm thinking they've already been getting through their residency and their training, many of them experiencing bias and feeling very isolated. And then now we add COVID and just the social isolation courtesy of this pandemic. And that is just an even more of a burden. There was a survey of over 7,000 surgical residents in the United States, and I think it was 2018-2019, and 16% of those residents reported racial discrimination. And I think there was like 30% was discrimination based on their gender. And then when you take that one step further, which the authors did, they went and just looked at what are some of the effects of that. And a number of these residents who reported discrimination based on their ethnicity or their race also had feelings of burnout, depression, and suicidal thoughts. And there have been a number of studies that painted a pretty clear association between burnout, depression, and the incidence of medical errors. If we don't address what is happening inside these spaces and really do more to try to create an environment that is supportive of our underrepresented in medicine. If they do make it, that's fantastic. But the harm that's caused, that for some is compelling them to leave medicine, is a problem, as well as a problem for them to try to thrive against these, to me, almost insurmountable odds, where they're being committed to an atmosphere that doesn't support them and that actually creates the potential for harm that can be transferred to the care of patients. So to me, it's a real serious commitment that all of our educational systems really need to look at their environment that they're bringing these medical students and these residents in. They're making a lot of efforts to bring them in, but they've got to finish, and they've got to finish healthy and well and be able to be the best physicians that they can possibly be. So COVID is reminding us how serious this is because patients are suffering because of COVID. There's no question. I think as of January 2021, just this past January, we have 16% of COVID deaths are African Americans. And that group is 13% of our U.S. population. That's a problem. And there are a number of socioeconomic determinants and health disparities that are contributing to this. So that has to be looked at. It has to be done in parallel, all together. So the work that we have to do, I think, is tremendous. And it's going to require a huge educational effort to make sure that our leaders are educationally equipped to lead the changes that all these institutions are trying to affect.
It seems like a lot of the disparities that you're pointing to have to be much worse in Oregon, given its history as an all-white state, given still the relatively small numbers of African-American people in the state.
Yes, Desiree, I agree. I think that when you talk about isolation, I mean, I think I've heard that word more than anything this summer. And, you know, at first I was kind of like, okay, yeah, it's COVID-19, we're wearing masks, we're socially distanced, the restaurants are closed, movies are closed. And even within the medical centers, there's a lot of limitations in terms of our ability to socialize. So it's very isolating. And then I go before COVID. And I think as an African American working here, when as OHSU, I had one other African colleague in the Department of Anesthesiology at OHSU. And I look at where I was working before OHSU, and there was no other African American that I was working with. And so while you have your colleagues, we have a lot in common in that I love anesthesiology. I practice in this field. I spent my whole life training to be an anesthesiologist. It's fantastic. And there's great collegiality in terms of that profession. But in terms of the feeling of being the only, very isolating. And then you add the vulnerability of being a resident or a trainee in an environment where there are very few like you. It's very isolating. It's one of the things that actually contributes to some people of color, African Americans, leaving the healthcare workforce. That's something that I think that here in Oregon, it becomes even more important that as African American residents, medical students, faculty come to Oregon, that these institutions need to make a much stronger effort to try to connect them to communities within Oregon so that they can thrive.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you're talking also about a largely white cohort, right, that's getting their medical training largely in isolation from colleagues of color, then that's also creating the racism and cultural incompetence among the peer folks who are training as part of that cohort.
When you look at the business world, they've been looking at the benefits in diversity, and they kind of focus on a lot of the financial aspects of it, more in innovation, more financial success. And then a lot of these ideas have kind of trickled into medicine, looking at different aspects of it, innovation and research, helping to address more health disparities, helping to make sure that groups have more access. But there's also the intellectual stimulation of whites, blacks, other people of color, international groups that are coming together and educating one another about one another's lives and getting some insight. This kind of insight is going to help these physicians become more empowered and more competent to be able to take care of the increasing diverse patient population that we're having. So the benefit is enormous of getting groups together and being able to engage with one another. But it does require some level of education and understanding one another's histories, one another's experiences, and one another's lives. So white faculty, white residents, white students have to be open to understanding the Black experience, understanding really it's American history, and understanding how we got to this point, and understanding how to get to the next stage. So the workshops that are being held, which OHSU has been doing, had a number of workshops available, WebExes and meetings and discussions. People have to be open to having these discussions, but then how to get to the next step.
I think this speaks also to undergraduate education and the need for really integrating work in comparative ethnic studies and the Black experience at the undergraduate level and BIPOC experience more broadly, right? So that as people are, they're getting some of that foundational knowledge earlier in their education as well. I just want to go back also to one of the comments that you were making about the percentage of Black residents who are dismissed. Black residents represent something like 20% of residents who are dismissed during their residency. Mm. That's a pretty shocking stat, especially in terms of what that means about the debt burden and the debt risk that Black students are taking on as they enter medical school, knowing that statistic down the road. And they're also coming in with less inherited intergenerational wealth to kind of buffer them.
Yes. So a lot of truths there. And it's very, very worrisome. And so the pressure is enormous. So talk about, you know, how do Black trainees get through knowing this? They're very aware of this. Feel it, you see it. Although it's very alarming to me, I've seen the reality of it. And as faculty, I do everything I can to try to help promote making sure that residents do get through their training program. Many of them internalize a lot of the stress and the isolation and the bias that goes along with living today in the state that we have right now, not really quite being anti-racist and dealing with all the accepting all the microaggressions and internalizing them and trying to get through. They're doing everything they can to get through because they know they have a huge debt to pay when this is all done. And by the time they're a resident, they're already, their debt is astronomical. By the time I started residency, I was already over $100,000 in debt. Today, that's pretty much triple. It'd be great if we could decrease the tuition bill for sure, but we also have to make the space more supportive for these residents. Otherwise, we're not going to be successful and doing what everyone is trying to work towards achieving.
You know, I just wanted to point to what I think is a particularly striking marker of health disparities in Multnomah County, and that's that in a 2014 study, the Multnomah County Health Department found that the Black African-American infant mortality rate was 2.6 times that of non-Hispanic whites. It's a really troubling statistic.
That is. That really is. And I'm sure that there are a number of socioeconomic determinants that have contributed to that. And I don't know what things are going to look like after we start looking at what COVID has left behind. But I just can't imagine it's going to go down because it's even more difficult to affect care now, particularly kind of that routine kind of care as opposed to the urgent. Very glad that pregnant women were some of the first that were getting COVID tested. Even the hospitals that were not doing any elective cases, any woman that came in pregnant was tested as soon as the test became available. So that was included in the protocol compared to like testing of urgent cases versus not urgent cases. But they looked at any pregnant woman as basically in that urgent category and tested them, which I'm very pleased because if they were COVID positive, they addressed them very differently, did a lot more testing, just making sure that they were able to be healthy and be able to deliver safely. So I'm really glad that they did that. But I wonder about if there were any problems in terms of access to care for people from underrepresented groups is what I worry about.
Dr. Teilhard, I can't thank you enough for making time out of your incredibly busy schedule to speak with me today. My guest today has been Dr. Angèle Teilhard, who is a medical director of neuroanesthesiology and an assistant professor of anesthesiology and perioperative medicine at the OHSU School of Medicine. When we post this segment, we will also post a link to an article that she co-authored with her spouse, Professor Tabidi Lewis of Washington State University, Vancouver. This has been Desiree Helliger for the Old Mill Variety Hour.